So welcome everyone to our weekly class, Parsha Review, Parshas Vayetze 5775. Title of the class tonight is How Dr. Jekyll Became Mr. Hyde. Dr. Jekyll we're referring to is our patriarch Jacob, Yaakov Avinu, and of course Mr. Hyde is the dark side of Jacob, his twin brother, Esav HaRasha, the wicked Esau. When we are introduced to the character of Jacob, he is, as we said last week in the class, he is the epitome of Mr. Truth, Emes. As we say, Yaakov Emet, Udvarcha Emet. Titein Emet LeYaakov. God gave truth to Jacob as his gift, as his defining characteristic. So the question is, as we're going to try to pursue tonight, how Jacob, as we are going to demonstrate in the first part of the class, how Jacob became much more Esau-like than is noticed unless you really, really are paying attention. So let's begin with the source number one, where we are introduced to the young lads, the youths. So the Torah tells us, this is from last week's Torah reading, Vayigdilu hane'arim, the young youths, Esau, firstborn, and Jacob, his younger brother, grew up. Vayihi Esav, and it was that Esav was Ish, a man, Yodea Tsayid, who knew how to hunt. Ish Sadeh, a man of the field. VeYaakov, and Jacob, Ish Tam, was a wholesome, pure, innocent man. Yoshev Ohalim, dwelling in tents. Rashi, Rabbi Shlomo Yitzchaki, then helps us to flesh out the character of the two brothers. So he's bothered by the following statement in the Torah. Why did it have to say that Esau is an Ish who is Yodea Tsayid, a man who knows how to hunt? Why not simply say he's a hunter? Ish Tsayid. What does it mean he knows how to hunt? So Rashi is going to understand this, that it's on two different levels. He was a hunter, yes, but he was a tzayid, the thief. He was someone who used words to trap and entrap others in his world. Because if it just wanted to tell us that he was simply a hunter, ish tzayid, the word yodea, knows how to do it, is some type of nefarious activity that is not conventional entrapment. And that's what Rashi says. Who knows hunting? Source number two. To ensnare and to deceive his father Isaac with his mouth, with his words. He, Esau, would ask his father. Isaac, he would say, Abba, how do we tie salt and straw? His father would be under the impression that Esau, was meticulous about the performance of commandments. And we said last week that Esau was not a fool. In fact, au contraire, he was a genius. An evil genius, yes, but a genius nevertheless. And it extends further than just to simply his father. He was someone who, if you were in a debate with him about anything, you probably were going to come up short. He was somebody who was a master of manipulation and double entendres and doublespeak. Very brilliant, brilliant man. Now, what about Jacob? So the contrast is very stark. Whereas Mr. Manipulator was Esau, Jacob's the opposite. So listen to what Rashi says. This is on source number three. Tam, he was wholesome. And I'll read the Hebrew, and you can read with me in the translation. Eino baki, he wasn't a baki, an expert. B'chol eila, in any of these things that Esau was a master of, meaning words, manipulation, chicanery, etc. Ella, but rather, kilibo chemviv, like what was in his heart, so was his mouth. He was very, very, as the Gemara in Brachot says, tocha kaboro. What was inside, what was reflected on the outside, and vice versa. There was nothing hidden from him. He wasn't even capable of such chicanery. She'enu charif lirmos karaitam. Anyone who is not sharp, who is not charif, like, for example, if you go to Israel and you make the mistake of ordering too much charif on your shawarma, oh boy, you know, Israel, they're serious there. So the word charif means very spicy, sharp. So someone who is a tam is someone who is she'inu charef, lirmot, to deceive, a ramai. Remember, that's the place of all deception. That's why Laban is called Laban ha'arami. The Aramean, but on a play of words, he's also Laban, the deceiver. So if you called him Laban deceiver, he probably would take this as a badge of honor. Because he came from a place, as we were going to see, of ramaut, of chicanery, of deception. So it was a badge of honor. Laban ha'arami, say thank you very much, that's me. Right? So someone who is a tam, in by Torah definition, by the definition of our parsha, a tam means the antithesis of everything Esau. So if, let's stop for a moment, take a time out. So at this moment, we would say, well, where are Jacob and Esau holding? Polar opposites. Okay? Brothers? Yes. Sharing tremendous amount of genes? Yes. But in terms of hanhaga, behavior, as far apart as you could have. Okay.
Could I just have one brief question? When it says the tithing of salt and straw, did I read a commentary that straw and salt are not tithed?
Correct. Because they are not grown from the ground. They're not produced from the ground.
But then it says his father would be under the impression that he was meticulous. Would you not think that his father would have known that?
Well, no. In other words, he would come to his father and say, you know, like, I'm not sure, Abba, but what is the halacha of taking meiser, of taking tithes from melah, from salt? So it's a chumra beyond a chumra. It doesn't even exist. It's a stringency that does not a reality.
But he raised the question. As
exactly. Meaning I'm so mocked that I'm so careful about tithing everything. I'll even tithe something that's not a product of the earth. We are only required to give back to God what God has given to us. So salt clearly is not a pre. It's not produced as a fruit of the land. So you're exempt from tithing salt. But he would go to Isaac. And he would debate with him the merits and demerits of whether one is commanded to tithe, giving the impression, oh my gosh, he thought to himself, my son Esau, oh boy, is he meticulous about observance of the commandments. He's even going beyond the letter of the law, right? So that was the impression that he gave.
Where does the straw fit into that?
Because straw is also something not, does not require tithing, because it wasn't produced directly from the earth, not in its iteration that it's in now. Originally, yes, but not in its current iteration. There's no achrayat. There's no responsibility to take tithe, straw, or salt. Okay? So they're both in that same category.
I don't follow it, but you'll tell me.
Okay. Let's carry on. So, poor Jacob is clearly not up to the task of having a brother like Esau, or so we think. But yet, let us fast forward to source number 4, and our parsha this week, Vayetze, and Jacob left home. He leaves Beersheba, he's on his way to Haran, to that area of Turkey, Iraq, Kuwait area, where the family comes from, Rebekah's family. Remember, his mother, Rebekah, comes from this area. That's where Eliezer specifically went to Parshiot to go in Chayisara to get a wife. And clearly, he was commanded by his mom and dad, go back to the same wellspring, because apparently they had wonderful shiduchim, wonderful dates, and wonderful girls to be had. Somehow, that's a bigger question. Why do we need to go back to this place of ramaut, this ramai, this place of deception? That's a separate drasha for another day. But suffice it to say, it's a long trip. Jacob famously goes on this journey, specifically to get a wife. Okay? But it's a different type of Jacob who shows up at the well. Because the well, of course, was the Starbucks, the place in those days to meet your future wife. Right? Today, you know, young men, young women, very often in their first date in the big city of Manhattan will meet at Starbucks or at Tasty Delight or at a hotel. The hotels, right. They meet in a hotel lobby at the Ritz-Carlton or something, and they have like a coffee or a drink together on their first day.
When I was in Israel.
Just to meet.
The King David, right. Reichstein, Alan was saying, see that over there?
Those are all dates. They're all shidduchim. Yes,
but
they're all going on dates.
You need to bring your camel to the well, isn't that?
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So, but think about it for a moment. All the great matches that we know of that were made in the Torah all come by the well, because we have Isaac's Besheret, Rebekah meets Eliezer by the well. Rachel, as you'll see, meets Jacob by the well. Moses meets his wife by the well, Zipporah. Right, and we live in a place you could call it, you know, Wilkes Be'er, It's cute. The word be'er means well, and you know, there are a multiplicity of pronunciations. So maybe we could sell ourselves to, you know, emerging communities. Come to Wilkes Be'er and meet your Be'erets, you know? That could be, I don't know, okay, I'm stretching a little bit. The word be'er means well. Okay. Oh well. Let's carry on. So let us now meet a new version. Let's call him Jacob 2.0, right? The update, right? This is with the software was originally Jacob 1.0. That was the original, the Tom. He's not so Tamimistic as we're going to see in a few moments, okay? So Jacob comes to the well. Now, who hangs out at a well? Well, believe it or not, the most disreputable characters, you know, the Lee Van Cleef bad guys from all the Good, Bad, the Ugly movies, those are the type of guys who hang out at the well, because the shepherds back then, by and large, were thieves and murderers, and you know, and these were their good qualities, okay? And they would hang out by the well, and apparently in the little village where Rebecca's family lived, the duplicity was so rampant that no one trusted each other. They all knew, you know, that we're all going to steal, and they were worried about the water supply, so they had this humongous giant stone that they put on top of the well to protect the integrity of the water, that only with major work of tons of shepherds could they hope to roll the stone off the top of the well and access the water supply, thereby ensuring that one person couldn't come and take all the water supply from them. Okay? So he comes to the well, and there's a bunch of good-for-nothing, lazy, bad guys hanging around, you know, smoking and doing whatever else they're doing. And listen to what Jacob does. He doesn't just go like, oh, hi, gentlemen, how are you? He does that also. But he gives them rebuke. Now, remember who he's rebuking. This is Jacob the Goody Two-Shoes. But this is Jacob, Mr. Simpleton, who's rebuking a bunch of escaped convicts, essentially, and giving them, like, admonition that they should do teshuvah, that you're stealing from your owners. So listen to what he says in source number four. But Yomer, and he says to them, he sees them not working, but they're on the clock. They should be working. So he says, Hein od hayom gadol? Well, wait a minute. Look, the day, there's more time in the day. The day's still long. Lo eis ha'asef ha'mikna. He says, it's not yet time to bring the livestock in. What are you guys, a bunch of lazy, good-for-nothing guys, just loitering around doing nothing? He says, hashku etzlan uchuru, come on, get back to work. Water the sheep, go on grazing. Come on, you're getting paid big bucks. Let's move, guys.
It's a union break.
Yeah, very well said, Jason. So this is totally, you would agree, out of character with Mr. Ishtam Yoshev Olim, the yeshiva guy who's sitting in the tents of learning all his life, sequestered and immersed, cut off from the reality of the world. And he's standing up to these nefarious strangers and admonishing them for being lazy, good-for-nothing guys stealing from them. Okay, that's step one. All right, it gets worse. So now, after admonishing the guys, then he meets his beloved future wife, Rachel. So it says like this, Vayehi, and it was, Ka'asher ra'a Yaakov es Rachel bas Lavan achi imo, when Jacob saw Rachel, daughter of Laban, achi imo, who was the brother of his mom, v'yasson Lavan achi imo, and the sheep belonging to Lavan, brother of his mother Rebecca, by Yigash Yaakov, that Jacob came close, by Yagel Esa Eden Me'al Pia Be'er. And he just rolled off, like Gemara says, that Thomas says, he popped it like a cork off a bottle of champagne. Just popped that by himself, this enormous stone that took the cumulative power of a whole bunch of these shepherds. Jacob alone popped it right off by himself in front of Rachel. He was inspired in a moment of bravado, shall we say.
He's 87 years old at this point.
He's 77 years old, correct. He pops the stone at age 77, me'al pia be'er, from on the mouth of that be'er, of the well, vayash ketzon Lavan achimo, and he himself goes and waters all the sheep belonging to Lavan, brother of his mom Rebecca. Vayishak Yaakov la Rachel, and then he goes over to Rachel and he kisses her. In public?
How did he know who she was?
Vayisos kolo vayev. He lifts up his voice and he cries. Vayaged Yaakov la Rachel, and then he went on to tell Rachel, ki achi aviyahu, that he was her father's brother. Vichiven Rivkahu, he also was the son of Rebecca. Vataratz, And the little girl, Rachel, runs. She goes to tell Dad Lavan that, guess what?
Some guy is
Jacob's in town. All right. I didn't quote the previous verse says that he starts talking to the shepherds, asking them questions. Where are you from? Blah, 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 right? And then they say, oh, here comes Laban's daughter, Rachel, right now with the sheep. So it was just out of context. I'm sorry, Bruce. So in other words, right before these verses, they had this little interplay between the shepherds and Jacob, and they're kind of a little upset with him for being annoying, and they say, look, go talk with the girl. Here she comes, the young little girl. You want to learn about Laban? Because he's asking questions. How is Laban? And they're like, what are you asking us for? You know, Laban's like the worst guy in town. How is he doing? He's stealing from everybody, killing everybody, but he's a great guy. Here comes his daughter. Go talk to her. You know, leave us alone. Go talk to the girls. It was a put-down, actually. Okay.
It wasn't that very much out of context for him to kiss her.
Oh, well, that's what we're going to say. Exactly. So listen. Right. Well, it's worse than this. Worse than this. Okay. Number one, he comes and admonishes the shepherds. Okay. We said that's a little bit of a problem. Then he comes and he sees Rachel. And in this moment of inspiration, shall we say, for his future bride, he goes and, you know, shows the muscles and, you know, Arnold Schwarzenegger like pops off that stone from the air, the well. And then he goes over and he gives her a kiss. I mean, he may have just given her a kiss on the cheek. They're cousins, right? In other words, Rachel and he are first cousins. So it's, you know, it's not so out of context, but it is a problem. Because the shepherds look at this guy and they say, oh my gosh, what did you come, Mr. Goody Two Shoes, to teach us morality? And this is how you're Mr. Morality? You're coming and kissing the girl in public? Right, Rachel knew who he was. So, I mean, and they fell in love immediately. He was like, it was love at first sight. That wasn't the issue. The issue was it's priestess. It's immoral to express this type of behavior in public in front of these shepherds. The shepherds are not going to look at this and take this in a nice way. And it becomes a huge issue. You know how it becomes a major issue? The plot device is enormous. Think about this. How does Lavan get away with hiding out Leah and passing her off as Rachel? Because he turns to his future son-in-law after 7 years of work and says, look, we're turning the lights out here. She's going to wear a complete veil. We're turning the lights out. And he starts to protest, like, well, I want to see my bride. No, wait a minute. You're the one who's Mr. Morality, kisses the girls in public and stuff, you know? Hey, we do things a little more on the up and up here where we come from. So how dare you impugn my morality when you have already shown yourself to be an immoral individual. So they actually use this against him later to trick him into marrying Leah instead of Rachel. So it's a big issue, not germane to tonight's class, but it's a big issue. So number one, to admonish the shepherds, which is really almost putting your life at risk. I mean, really, that the audacity. I mean, can you imagine, LaMarshall, you know, you're walking in a subway train, going on a subway train in New York, and up, you know, after a Yankees game, 3 hours after the Yankees are gone, okay, game's over, you stay for some autographs, Derek Jeter left, you got your autographs, you're coming back, you're by yourself, it's 3 hours after the game, so it's 2 a.m. on a Saturday night, and you're at that station all by yourself, and there's a gang of, you know, Satan's choice guys, 8 of them come by, and they start smoking, they drop a cigarette down on the ground. So you're a yeshiva guy, you're going to go over and say, hey, pick up that cigarette, you know, the mayor has rules against that. Really? I mean, that's exactly what he did. I mean, okay, that's the mashal, that's the parallel, that's the analogy. So that's not Jacob behavior. Then, like you said, to show this public strength and bravado, that's not exactly Jacob. And then to kiss the girl in public? Oh my gosh. Okay, let's turn the page. It gets worse, though. Source number 6. And he tells Rachel that I am your father Laban, Lavan's brother. Now, of course, that's not true. You might say, oh, come on, they weren't really, you know, we're not talking like literal brother. I mean, it's like, we're blood brothers, we're relatives, right? Okay, so that's one possible explanation. That's what Rashi says. Pashuk Shat, simple explanation, right? Ki achi aviyahu, what do you mean? They weren't really brother and brother. So Rashi says, no, karov l'aviyah. Relative of the father. Like earlier on, back in chapter 13, where it said we're like brothers. Doesn't mean literally brothers. It's a figurative speech that we're related. Okay, but that's the simple explanation. The midrashic explanation, the oral medrash, tells us in the oral law that, oh my gosh, listen to this. You talk about bravado, and this sounds like an outright lie, an egregious lie. Listen to what he tells Rachel. Im liramos huba. If your father's coming to cheat me, He's coming to be Laban the deceiver. Bo gamani achi v'ramos. Boy, I'm going to take him to task. I am going to be the Rebbe, the master of deception, and I'm going to cheat your father back, and I'm going to just take everything that's his. If he, Laban, comes for deceit, I too am his brother in deceit. I'm going to take him to the cleaners. However, then why did I have to go on to say, by the way, I'm also a Ben Rivka. I'm also a son of Rebecca. Isn't it enough to say that they're related to the dad? Why mention the mom, right? Oh, so Rashi says, but if he's a decent person, im adam kosher hu, if he's a kosher person, a decent person, an upstanding citizen, and he treats me like a mensch, then gamani ben Rivka chosak shera, I am also a son of Rebecca, his decent sister. So either way, your father wants to do it. Chicanery, I'm more than up to the task. He wants to be a mensch. Okay, I'm also Rebecca's son. Really? I don't understand. At the beginning of the last parsha, we defined the essence of Jacob, Ish Tam, and we even went out of our way, and Rashi said this, that what is a Tam? A simple, wholesome individual who doesn't understand. Ain't no baki, right? Has no expertise in chicanery and manipulation. So is this a lie coming from Mr. Emes? You can't say it's a lie. Chas v'chalila. Jacob's not lying. If he says to Rachel's future bride, I can handle your father, then he can handle his father, her father. Well, how did this happen? Now, do you see a common theme here that the behavior, if you analyze this, of Jacob after leaving home in the aftermath of taking the blessings in disguise from dear father Isaac? This is not the Jacob that we knew before. This is a 2.0 version. This is almost more like an Esau version of Jacob. Would you agree? Gets worse. Who does he marry? Now, albeit through chicanery of Laban, but who does he end up marrying? Leah. Not Rachel. He marries Leah. Now,
he worked the 7 years for Rachel. And
correct.
He for Leah.
But he gets Leah. Who was the intended for Leah?
Some other guy.
Esav. When the twins were born to Isaac and Rebekah, everyone said, well, we're going to rent the shidduch when they're little. We're making the match. It's going to be the older for the older and the younger for the younger. So obviously they were destined to marry each other. Esav was going to marry Leah because they were both the firstborn. And Jacob was destined to marry Rachel. So in fact, the Medrash says that, listen to this quote. The oral tradition says that when Jacob says, oh my gosh, after he realizes the next morning that he married Leah, he says, oh my gosh, if my brother Esau hated me because of the firstborn issue, he's going to really hate me because I married his girl. I took away Leah. He's going to, oh my gosh, he's going to go ballistic when he hears that I took Leah. And you see very, very simply in number 7, and it was in the evening that he, Laban, took Leah, his daughter, and brought her to him, to Jacob. So he even gets to marry the intended of Esau, of Esau. How did this happen? Now, let's step back for a moment. When did this transformation, when did Dr. Jekyll become Mr. Hyde all of a sudden? Because he's acting a lot more like Mr. Hyde, Esau, than like Mr. Dr. Jekyll. Would you all agree? Well, I believe the beginning, the hatchala, the haschala, the beginning snippets of this transformation happened. They already happened last week. We had a class about this, okay? So let's just look very, very clear inside, okay? And when did it happen? It happened in number 8. When he dresses up as his brother Esau, and under strict orders from mom Rebecca, he goes, Jacob does, and he puts on a little one-act play. He gets the blessings. And in the aftermath of his chicanery, when Esau comes in as Jacob leaves, and Isaac, their father, finally realizes who the sons are, who Esau really is, and who Jacob really is, Isaac responds to the chicanery of Jacob in a very strange way. Let's look at source number 8. And Isaac, his father, said to him when Esau comes in, who are you, he says. Mi ata? And Esau said, Ani b'chincha b'chorcha Esav. I'm your firstborn son, Esau. And it says, Isaac just trembled tremendously. He was about to have a heart attack. Vayecharad Yitzchak charada gedola ad ma'od. He trembled, a tremendous trembling, charada, vayomer. And he said, you can hear Isaac speaking this out loud, but he's putting the pieces together. And he says, mi eifo, who, where? Who at Tzatzai, this person who came, the one who caught the game, vayabeli, he brought it to me, the food, va'ochal, mikol b'term tovo, and he brought it to me, and I ate all of, when you had not yet come, you hadn't come yet, you weren't here, Esau. Va'avarcheu, and I blessed him. In other words, you can hear Isaac's putting all the pieces together in his own mind. And then he issues the most startling statement. Gam, it's in bold, Gam Baruch Yihyeh. He shall also be blessed. The blessing that I gave to Jacob disguised as Esau, Mr. Esau, Gam Baruch Yihyeh. I'm validating that blessing. Now remember, this is a huge issue because even Jacob was worried. Oh my gosh, Dad's going to inevitably discover the ruse and he's going to curse me. If he has the ability to bless me, he also has the ability to retroactively curse me when he discovers what I did to him. No, not only does he not take back what he gave, he validates it right in front of Esau. He says, Gam Baruch! In open, I'm now declaring he deserves the blessing, not you, Esau. Sorry. And he goes on to say, Vayomer Balchich b'mirma, your brother came b'mirma, with cleverness, chicanery, Vayikach birchasecho, and he took your blessing, Esau. Now this is not a small issue. First of all, what is Isaac clearly responding to when he says, Gam Baruch Yihyeh, that he should be blessed? He's responding to figuring out the whole pieces of the play, the parts, who Jacob was, who Jacob is, what Jacob perpetrated. It's obviously more than that, though. He's also figuring out 63 years of history here, because the twins are 63 years old. So he's going back in his mind now, and he's trying to put all of the disparate parts together. I've been living a lie. My entire relationship with my oldest son, Esau, is a total fabrication. Never happened. Now I see that. I understand what my wife is trying to show me, Rebecca. And I understand who Jacob is, and he is deserving of the blessings. But it's more than that. Because he's saying, Gam Baruch Yihyeh is a validation of Jacob as a response to who Jacob could be. Now let's examine for a moment the relationship with Isaac, with Esau. Isaac, Chas V'Shalom, God forbid, was not delusional. He wasn't under the impression that Esau is righteous. But what he was under the impression was that perhaps the two brothers could work harmoniously together the way two future tribes, Yisachar and Zevulun, would work in harmony together as partners in this world and in the next world. Zevulun were the richest of the tribes. They went out, made tons of money on the high seas. They were sailors. They made a ton of money. Their brother Yisachar sat and learned Torah all day in Kollel, but they had a partnership. Zevulun would pay for the Torah of Yisachar, and in return, in exchange, half of the accumulated sechar, all that reward in this world and next world that was coming for the Torah and the righteousness of Yisachar, would be given to his brother Zevulun, who supported him in Torah. So this is the paradigm for how rich, wealthy benefactors will support Torah institutions, because it's a give and take in a very positive, beautiful way. This was the vision, clearly, of Isaac. He knew Esau's not going to sit in Yeshiva and learn Torah. That's Jacob. But he also had his reservations about Jacob, because he thought, come on, he's Ish Tam Yoshev Ohalim. He's just sitting in the walls of a tent learning Torah all day. What does he know about the real world? If I give him everything alone, he's not a man of accomplishment. He can't go out and create civilizations. That's what Esau could do. Esau could build a world, which he did, by the way. I mean, remember, his progeny are the Romans and everything else. Our world, Western Europe, civilization that we call civilization today, are all products of Esau. So clearly he did a really good job at this. He built the world. But what about Jacob? Well, Jacob and he were going to share this world and the next world. This was the vision of Isaac. But boy, it was misplaced, right? Because Esau, this wasn't going to work. It wasn't Issachar and Zebulun. It wasn't going to be a very nice, neutral, benevolent relationship, a benign relationship. It would have exploded and wiped out the Jews. So what was the response? Isaac, after the act, after the play was over and all was revealed, the Gam Baruch Yehiyah is going back on Jacob, pulling off the little stunt. And he's thinking to himself, wait a minute, who did this? Who dressed like his brother and faked me out and got the blessings? Jacob did this? What? I thought he was the yeshiva guy, you know? Oh my gosh, he is capable. If he could pull this off, maybe he doesn't need to partner up with dear brother Esau. Maybe he could do it all alone. And that's why he says, Gam Baruch Yehiyah, as a response to the Mirma, the Yaakov, the Agveni, the underhanded duplicity of Jacob, elicited in dad Isaac the response, Gam Baruch Yehiyah. He could do it by himself. He doesn't need Esau. He could go out and build a world and have the Torah and Mada, the real world, and the Torah learning all together. Jacob did it all alone. That's why we don't need you, Esau. That's why Esau goes crazy. He goes, come on, Dad, give me something. But there's a problem, ladies and gentlemen. It's a big problem here. Look at the last words of source number 7. Jacob takes the blessings. But which blessings does he take? He takes Esau's blessings, correct? Look what Dad said. Isaac said, and I'll read it to you. This is verse 35. And Isaac said, he said, your brother came with cleverness and took your blessing. Now, ladies and gentlemen, a blessing is not like some generic thing that if I design it for Bill, Bob can take it. It works for Bill and Bill alone. It's nuanced to the nines. It cannot work for somebody other than Bill. So if Bob somehow dresses up like Bill and gets the blessing, it won't work. It won't help him. So the fact that Jacob took Esau's blessing, how does that help Jacob? He's not Esau. The blessing was given by Isaac to Esau. It wasn't given to Jacob. Unless what? There's only one possible answer. That Jacob as the twin has to somehow subsume within his personality and his character, the other half of the twin. Mr. Hyde has to become part of Dr. Jekyll in order for the blessings to take effect. You hear that? In other words, the only way that the blessings can be realized in Jacob, the blessing of an Esau, is for him to take what is Esau and to subsume this in his character. And perhaps this is how he did this. And you see the result because when he shows up by the well, he's already Esau. He's kissing the girl, he's taking the rock off, he's cursing out the shepherds. He says, oh, I could take your dad Laban to the cleaners. I'm Esav now, I have that. I have the capability, no problem. Your dad doesn't want to act nicely to him, Rachel? No worries, I'll take him on. That's Esav bravado, yeah. Because somehow on this little journey, Jacob became Esav, or he subsumed so much so that he could marry Esav's girl. Leah becomes his wife, and it works. In fact, Leah's a better match for him than Rachel in some ways. In fact, Leah, when he gets angry, he says, how could you have gone along with this ruse? I understand Dad did this. But Leah, you shut up and said nothing. Why didn't you tell me who you were? You know what she said? You're my Rebbe. You're my teacher, Jacob. Weren't you the one who dressed up as your brother? So I'm no different. I dress up as my sister. You taught me. You're my Rebbe. You're my inspiration. I'm sure Jacob was like, whoa, my gosh, right? Why did I marry the right girl? Right? That's the girl. And of course, in the end, the irony, such an irony, is that although he has this mad, mad, amazing love with Rachel, that he only gets to share for a very brief time because she tragically dies at age 36, in the end, it's the Leah marriage that gives him Messiah. It's Leah that gives him the temple. Because Levi, the Levites, the Kohanim, that's Leah. Judah, that's Leah. So yes, Joseph's wonderful. But Mashiach ben Yosef, what happens to Messiah, son of Joseph? Not a good ending, right? According to most people, sure. The Messiah, son of Joseph, is not going to eat. Some say he does live and gets to share the messianic vision with Messiah, son of David. Others say he dies. It's not a good thing, right?
No.
That's what some say. But Saul did not have a happy ending, whereas King David and Solomon, exactly, they have a very happy ending. So the Mashiach ben David is Judah. So it's clearly the vision. Even Jacob probably didn't even understand himself how wonderful Leah was. The only thing that diminished Leah was her what? Her fear of marrying Esau. So she cried all the time. She was equally as gorgeous and as beautiful as Rachel. But because she cried from the moment she heard her mom and dad talking, oh my gosh, you know, Esau, Leah are going to be a couple when they grow up. So poor Leah spent every single night davening to God and crying her eyes out, where the tears ruined her complexion. So her eyes were tender and they weren't beautiful anymore because of her prayers, her unrequited prayer to not marry Esau. And in the end, it was given to her. She got to marry Jacob too. Well, it's beautiful, right? I mean, it works out in a very beautiful way. So here's the last question we're left with. We understand that in order for the blessings that were given by Isaac to Jacob by mistake, from Isaac's perspective, in order for them to have an effect on Jacob, because they were specifically geared to be given to Esau, he thought he was giving the blessings to Esau, clearly then the only way that blessing can become part of the reality of Jacob is if Jacob takes the part of Esau and incorporates that into himself, which we see very clearly from his actions he seemed to have done. The question we're left with is, how did he do this? Okay, I'm glad you asked. Number 9. Well, yes, Givera.
Birthday.
Mm-hmm. Oh, Mazel Tov.
And I'm reading Gam Baruch.
Beautiful, beautiful.
And I was there for lunch, so
that's great. That's beautiful, Mazel Tov.
I used that also for his bar mitzvah.
Gam Baruch Hiya. That's beautiful. That's beautiful. That's beautiful. Thank you for sharing. So, source number 9. So, when Jacob leaves town, he comes to the future site of the temple in Jerusalem. You know that place where Jews aren't allowed to pray right now? That's under a tremendous amount of dispute. The hot place of the whole world, right? Where Rabbi Glick was almost murdered because he dared say that Jews should be allowed to pray there on that near the Temple Mount. I mean, think of the insanity that Arab Muslims can pray 5 times a day there. And a Jew, if they even open their mouth in prayer, they're hauled off to jail. Seems a little strange that we're almost like our own worst enemies. It's ironic that everything in the Torah we see, like in the Parsha, is literally what's going on in the world today. I mean, when we spoke last week about the terrorist, I don't know what to call it, carnage in the synagogue, we see it right with Hakol Kol Yaakov. You know, Jews are praying, and Esav comes and murders, right? Amalekites. And then this week, the idea of the Temple Mount. I mean, it was literally that stone that Jacob sleeps on, that becomes the foundational stone of the temple, right? And it's right in the Parsha. They're right there. Okay, so number 9. So Jacob encountered the place, Mount Moriah, the future Makom HaMikdash, place of the temple, and he spent the night there because the sun had set. God deliberately put the sun down early because he said, you got to stay at my hotel. It's not right. You know, I want you to sleep here, which of course everyone wants to sleep in the Beit HaMikdash. I mean, come on. That's another question. He took from the stones of the place and he put them around his head and lay down in that place. It says, Vayishkav, that he lay down, b'makom hahu. And Rashi, last source, number 10, and he lay down in that place. Vayishkav b'makom hahu. Lashon mute. It's a type of language that excludes, that is memayit, that exclusionary language. Be also makom shachav. Yes, in that place in Jerusalem, Jacob slept that night there. Aval, but yud dalet shanim, arba meos, arba asar shanim, for 14 years, she shimesh beveis aver, that he served, that he did shimush, in the house of Aver, the Yeshiva Shem and Aver, lo shechav b'layla. He never slept at night in his bed. Shahaya osik b'Torah, for he was occupied with the study of Torah. So he probably fell asleep over his learning, like this. He put his head down and he fell asleep for a couple hours over his art scroll Gemara, you know, his Shang Sing Gemara. Okay, so here's the question that was asked last week. Okay, Rabbi, I get it. There was a yeshiva called Shem and Aver. What books did they have in the Beis Medrash walls? Now, let's think of who Shem and Aver were. They were the son and great-grandson of Noah. So they weren't even Jews. They weren't Jewish because it's way before Abraham. Mr. Abraham. In fact, Shem is an antediluvian, right? He's before the flood. He's one of the survivors of the flood. So it's going way back. So there are no Jews in the world, and yet they set up a yeshiva of Shem and Aver. So now, even if they were Jews, this is obviously Kodem Matan Torah, right? It's way before the Torah is given. So way before Sinai and the Revelation, and way before, I know it's going to be a stunner, and way before Art Scroll even existed, okay? So the question is, what books did they have on the base Medrash walls there? Probably not a lot. So there was oral law, correct? It was obviously Torah Shabbat. But what Torah was taught there? And more specifically, he spent 14 years learning there, like he was really desirous and really engaged to get whatever was there. I mean, it wasn't just that he went there and, you know, went to yeshiva, but I didn't really go to class. No. He was there yom and v'layla, day and night. He's there learning, steiging, learning. But what was he learning exactly? And he had a pretty good Rebbe and a pretty good first Rebbe. I mean, Abraham and Isaac were his teachers. Do you really need to go beyond the Torah of Abraham and Isaac? I mean, come on, right? You're taught by Rabbi Akiva and, you know, Moshe Rabbeinu. Oh, no, I want to go to a couple of non-Jewish guys learning Torah out there in the middle of nowhere. Really? Rabbi Akiva and Moses weren't good enough for you? You know, I mean, it's a little suspect. All right. I would say to you the following, that the Yeshiva Shem and Aver was unique in one very special aspect, something that Isaac and Abraham even could not give to Jacob. See, the Torah that they gave to Jacob was the Torah of Israel, the Torah of Canaan, of the Canaanite land. Torah of Israel, which is a very beautiful Torah. It is our Torah. But there's a Torah that was missing, the Torah of Galus, of Galut, of the diaspora. How does a Jew survive outside of Israel? Now remember, when he sees the angels, Olim v'Yordim, going up and down the ladder, and he sees, if you've learned this inside, you'll understand what I'm talking about, each time the Tsar, the protective angel of each nation, who would be subservient in diaspora to each of these nations, the Tsar went up, and they fell off the ladder after X amount of rungs. And finally he sees the Tsar, the protective angel of Edom, of Esau, going way up into the sky, not falling down. By the way, we're in his exile, so those 2,000 years, etc., and counting. Okay, so Jacob is like, oh my gosh, is this exile, is this darkness ever going to end? So it's intimately tied, the vision of the angels, with the future diaspora. In other words, he's going to the diaspora. It's Jacob, Israel, going to leave Israel to go to a place of Laban. You can't get any more dark, the dark side, than going to Uncle Laban, to Lavan, Harami. So what did he need before he went there? He needed a special Torah to survive, because no one survives Lavan. I mean, you got to remember, next week's Parsha, he comes back and he says to his messengers, right, he says, I got a little message for my dear beloved Esau brother. FedEx guys, he sends the Malachim, you know, the messengers. He says, guys, as Dr. Bruce said, he says, tell him the following words. Im Lavan Garti, I dwell with Lavan. Right? And Rashi says that Garti means Taryag, inverted. I kept 613 mitzvos. I did not learn from his bad ways, but I beat him at his game. And when Esau would get this news that his brother lived with Uncle Lavan, I mean, why was Lavan a sanctuary, a near Miklat, a city of refuge for Jacob from his brother? Because even Esau's not going to touch him there. He's untouchable in the island of Lavan. Even Esau knows, dear Uncle Lavan, you don't mess with Lavan. Nobody comes out with their soul intact. And Jacob's saying, no. Not only am I back, I'm better than before. And not only that, I overcame him. I beat him at his own game. And Esau must have, we know that he was just shaken by this news. And in fact, when he sees Jacob come, and Jacob starts bowing and doing stuff which seems to contradict his power, Esau thinks, I don't understand. He has all these superpowers. How come he's acting like a schlepper? We'll try to answer that next week, please God. But for now, I want you to understand the following. Living with Lavan for 20 years, and surviving, more than surviving, coming back with all the money and all the children, all the girls and everything, is probably one of the most amazing accomplishments in history. How did he pull this off? He pulled it off because he needed to go to Shem and Aver. And I'm sure question one he asked Shem, how did you survive the flood? Aver, how did you survive the Torah HaFlaga, the generation of the dispersal, the Tower of Babylon? Everyone else, you know, was wiped out and dispersed. You somehow rose above it all. How? the Torah that Shem and Aver could offer Jacob was unique. It was a Torah, I don't know what it was exactly, but it was a way of living and secrets and the real Torah of how Jews survive in the diaspora. And think about the gift that we were given, because that Torah has enabled us to survive all these thousands of years. Thousands of years of darkness. We've survived because Jacob studied for 14 years in the Yeshiva Shem and Aver, and what he learned became part of the Jewish genetics. And it's been given to us as a gift. And that's why it's only after this that he becomes Israel. When he comes back, he wrestles with the angel, Kisarisa im anashim ve'im, im Elokim ve'im anashim. You wrestled with angel of God, and with Lavan and Issa batuchal, and you overcame them both, you beat them both. You're Israel. So the reason he's Israel, the reason we're Israel, the reason we're learning Torah tonight, is specifically because he spent 14 years learning the mysteries and the secrets that only Shem and Aver, who were privy to the worst, most heinous generations ever, right? The generation of the flood, the generation of the dispersion, they were able to overcome it. And that's what Jacob needed, and he got it. And with that, he was able to transform himself in the Jacob way. So he's still Jacob, but he also subsumes Esau. And that's why he can be both. And that's why he can so beautifully say to Rachel, without one shred of bravado, he's not lying, he says, look, I can give both. Your dad wants to behave nicely, I'm the son of Rebecca. Your dad wants to act like the Ramai, the deceiver, I'm ready, I'm his brother. I'll take him to, no problem at all. Both are true. Because this is how, as we've discovered tonight, Dr. Jekyll became Mr. Hyde. Shabbat Shalom.